This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
Hello, and welcome to Mountain News and World Report. I'm your host, Rachel Geringer. After a historic 9-day statewide strike, West Virginia's teachers returned to the classrooms this week. While the strike has ended, the lessons to be learned from this historic action have not. Last week, I spoke with teachers about their personal reasons for striking, how this strike fits into histories of labor organizing in West Virginia, and their visions for the future.
My name is Thomas Jude. I am a teacher in Mingo County, which is southern West Virginia, right on the border of Kentucky, eastern Kentucky. And I am a music teacher here. I've spent about 3 years in high school, and I'm currently teaching at a pre-K through 8 school, where I'm the band director. I'm in charge of choral and also general music for first grade through 8th grade. And I'm connected to the strike because it all kind of started in Mingo County, and now it's affecting everybody in the state.
Could you talk about sort of how it started? So I've heard a few different teachers. I've talked to somebody in Berkeley County, some folks in Greenbrier County, someone in Randolph County, and everybody referenced that it sort of started down in the coal fields. And so I'm wondering if you could talk about sort of like how the strike started from down that way.
You know, a really big history when it comes to unions and UMWA especially. So, you know, a lot of people have that, you know, at some point they've had a family member who's been through a strike or who worked for a union mines of some sort. And people are really proud of that. And I think what really started this whole thing and pushed people over the edge was a program called Go 365. And essentially what it wanted to do is they wanted to use an app for like your smartphone, and you had to submit like measurements of your body. You had to answer questions about your health. I mean, even questions as personal as things about your sex life. You had to commit to eat certain foods every day, and then log those on your app. And that would all be fine, except for it was a punitive system. So you weren't rewarded for partaking in the program. You were actually punished if you did not. And there's been a lot of unrest since I've been teaching. I'm in my fourth year now, and people talk about how benefits have gotten worse over the years, and I know the pay is not great, and I just think that the Go 365 is what really, it's what people needed to push them over the edge, and that's exactly what happened. About the same time, Richard Ojeda from Logan County, West Virginia, really started talking about a gas severance tax and how the money is there to provide for better funding for education, better benefits for teachers, pay increases. And I just think all those things came together at just the right time, and it pushed people over the edge. We just saw, you know, there is money here. Our state can do better for us. And this Go 365 program is the last straw. It was kind of like a slap in the face to teachers.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about, like, you mentioned that there's a lot of history of labor organizing in Mingo County and that part of the state. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that history and what do you think it means that that's where this strike is being led from, too?
I mean, I can't speak to as much of it personally because I don't have as many family connections to the union. But I just know that, you know, you're growing up in a place where you hear about the Mate One massacre. And you hear about, you know, the labor movement in regard to all of that and how, you know, scabs were brought in and the workers were replaced. And it just turned really, really ugly. And, you know, people just have a history of supporting unions in the area. I've even been skeptical to kind of be out and about in the community. Went to get a haircut last week, and I was kind of afraid of taking some heat from people in the community. But, you know, our local barber, even, he told me, he said, when I was growing up, I remember a time when my dad was on strike for an entire year and offered nothing but like very encouraging words and to stay out until we got a fair deal and that the people in the community understood.
My name's Jim Alder. I live in Caldwell, West Virginia. I'm the band director at Greenbrier East High School. And for the past week, I've been away from my students because I'm trying to fight for public employees' rights in terms of having proper insurance and acceptable wages for our West Virginia public employees, teachers, et cetera.
I guess I have another question for you, which is just, you know, I think some of the critique is that, you know, while the teachers are on strike, the students aren't in school and that this isn't good for students. How do you feel like the strike is actually about teachers caring about students? Or do you think it is? Not to put an answer in your mouth.
I absolutely do think it's about that. Okay. This goes a little bit more long term, but I feel that there have been efforts nationwide through various political action groups, through legislative conglomerates like ALEC, et cetera, to undermine and erode support for public education so that there can be more justification for things like vouchers for charter schools and, private schools, et cetera. I think public education is hugely valuable. We don't pick and choose our students. You know, we serve everyone. And if public schools are eroded to the point where we're not trusted to do that, where we don't have the funding to do that, where teachers cannot afford to continue to work in these systems, then ultimately, who's going to suffer the most? The students. The people who are able to, afford fancy schools, whatnot. You know, they're going to succeed no matter what. But what about the poor kids? What about the kids who come from disadvantaged situations? I guess that's what crosses my mind the most right now. In addition to that, you know, we have a brain drain in West Virginia right now. We have, if I go to my smartest students at Greenbrier East High School and ask them what their plans are for after graduating school, most of them say they plan to go to college. And a lot of them will say they're going to go to an in-state college because they can get better tuition rates there. But they'll also say that once they graduate from college, their plan is to go to another state because they don't feel like they can make a living here. They don't feel like there's, really any future for them here. And you know what? The ones that I hear that the most are the ones who are interested in education. The ones who might want to come back and be great teachers here and pass on knowledge to the next generation want to leave because they don't think they'll be able to afford to do it here. So it absolutely is about the students. It's also absolutely about the future of our entire state. And, we're not just fighting this fight for ourselves. It's way bigger than that.
My name is Danielle Kenny. I am a middle school teacher in Berkeley County, West Virginia. I teach at Martinsburg South Middle School. I teach 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. I have a bachelor's of arts in secondary education, family and consumer science, 5 through adult. I started out, I was considered a non-traditional student when I decided to go to college. I was 28 years old. I had a 3-year-old daughter and a 6-month-old son. And I wanted to be able to find a career that I could raise my children. I didn't want to be that parent that always had to rely on childcare in order to be able to support them. So I went into education, and I love it. I've been doing this now. This is I'll be ending up my 13th year this year when we end in June.
Great. And so how did you get involved in the strike?
Well, honestly, our state has not recognized for a long time what our teachers do, and we have been neglected in pay and benefits, and over the course of just 10 years, the difference in our insurance, and that's huge for me because my daughter at 3 years old was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, so she is insulin dependent, and when I started out with her with my PEIA, my co-pays, I could get, she's on two different types of insulin, and her meters were covered, her Lancets were covered, her test strips were covered. I'd pay $25 for each type of her insulin. And now, going forward 10 years later, I pay copays on her Lancets, I pay copays on her test strips. In 10 years, they have changed her test meter 6 different times. 1 year they say they won't cover something, the next year they do. Her insulin now costs me $50 for each type of insulin. They're taking so much away from us with our benefits that we can't afford it.
So my name is Emily Haas. I live in Greenbrier County. I work at Greenbrier East High School. I teach grades 9 through 11, and I've been a teacher for 3 years. But I've done lots of nonprofit work prior to that.
Yeah. Well, so you just said that you think this is the beginning. Do you have thoughts on sort of what the most ideal end goal would be? And is it just about pay raise? Is it about healthcare access for folks beyond public employees? Like what do you think, in your opinion, would be like the you know, most amazing outcome of this?
The most amazing outcome, I think, is if they could invest in their educators, which ultimately invest in the students. You know, if they can invest in education, then they're immediately investing in their students. And I believe that everybody should have access to affordable health care.
Yeah.
I just believe that everyone should have access equally to affordable health care.
Yeah.
And, you know, especially people who are, I feel like, in those service industries. I mean, I feel like, you know, the people who are protecting us and caring for our children and caring for other people and keeping them well and healthy. I mean, we've got to take care of each other. I mean, this world rips us apart enough, you know, that we just really, I mean, it goes back to equality and social justice, and just there isn't anyone who deserves something better. We all deserve something magnificent.
Next, on this episode of Mountain News and World Report, we'll hear 3 pieces from the Ohio Valley Resource. First, we'll hear about farmers' attempts to decide whether or not to use a controversial weed killer.
Ohio Valley farmers are facing some tough decisions about whether to use a controversial herbicide blamed for damaging millions of acres of crops. The spray dicamba is meant to protect soybeans from weeds, but it can harm other plants if improperly applied. Nicole Irwin reports that even some farmers trained on proper use of the herbicide say it might not be worth the risk.
Jeff McGrew is in line with about 30 other West Kentucky farmers awaiting certification that they've been trained to apply the herbicide dicamba. The 2-hour session explained the Environmental Protection Agency's new restrictions on use of the controversial herbicide. The session left McGrew uncertain about whether to use the spray.
I'm undecided right now, but I'm leaning towards not spraying it. I don't think in our area we're going to have much of any place that there will be enough area that we won't have buffer zones or other sensitive crops, and I'm not sure that it's going to work out for us.
EPA requires all users have training before they can legally apply the product. As The Resource reported in September, soybean farmers in the region claim more than 50,000 acres of crops were affected by herbicide misuse in 2017. McGrew is worried about damage at a farm he plans to rent this year.
Part of the ground that we farm is on the river bottoms, right on the edge of the Ohio River, and we're concerned about some drift coming across the river from Illinois, and we have no idea who those people are.
Dicamba label changes require applicators to follow strict guidelines. For example, the herbicide can't be sprayed if the wind is faster than 10 miles per hour and slower than 3 miles per hour. University of Arkansas soybean agronomist Jeremy Ross says the label is nearly impossible to follow.
I think now, you know, we pretty much opened Pandora's box, and I think as rapidly as technology is changing and some of these issues are coming up, you know, it's going to be difficult to slow down much and not get too far behind.
Ross says the dicamba controversy has larger implications for soybean growers and for several agribiz giants. Dicamba is sold by Monsanto, BASF, Dow DuPont, and intended for use with Monsanto's genetically modified soybeans. The beans, called Extendimax, are designed to grow with the dicamba application.
There's probably fear there that if the beans are still available, there's going to be always be that chance that somebody's going to use some off-target products. To eliminate that issue, then the only option is to pull the technology completely off the market.
Ross says some farmers are planting the Extendimax beans but not spraying dicamba. They are depending on other herbicides such as Roundup instead. But many weeds have grown resistant to Roundup.
Weed resistance has been a challenge for farmers, and having dicamba as a solution both for this coming season and beyond is critical, and we continue to hear that feedback from farmers across the U.S.
That's Monsanto product manager Ryan Rubshiko. He says Monsanto has not considered pulling their Xtend soybeans from market like Ross fears. Instead, he says Monsanto is focusing on training efforts and a digital tool to assist applicators.
We've spent a number of years breeding for this new technology, and so not only from a weed resistance perspective, this provides a new solution, but certainly from a yield component, it speaks to the amount of increase in adoption of this technology for this coming season.
Arkansas has the strongest restrictions so far on dicamba. Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky have limited restrictions to those listed on the EPA label. Kentucky-certified commercial applicator John Futrell says the training is helpful, but he will only be spraying dicamba for farmers early in the season, before plants have started to surface from the ground.
Most people are pretty pessimistic with it, and that's kind of where I am. I don't want to take a big risk, you know, a sensitive area and end up losing my insurance or something like that. Not worth it to me.
Soybean farmer Jeff McGrew says the weeds aren't bad enough for him to take the risk either.
After seeing the training today and realizing how much drift problems we could have, that's a huge problem with me. I don't want to have to buy somebody's bean crop out of my pocket.
In the meantime, he says he'll use other herbicides and look at implementing cover crops into his soil management plan. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Nicole Irwin.
Next, we'll learn about investigations into a recent rise in HIV in the region that has been linked to needle drug use.
Health officials in the Ohio Valley are investigating outbreaks of disease associated with needle drug use in what is emerging as a new public health threat from the region's opioid crisis. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control identifies 40 new HIV cases in southern West Virginia. And in northern Kentucky, health officials are investigating another cluster of HIV cases. Health officials say the stigma associated with HIV can add to the risk of widespread outbreaks. Reporter Roxy Todd of West Virginia Public Broadcasting visited with some people living with the disease and its stigma. It's the first story in our series, Rural Risk, HIV, and the Opioid Crisis.
Carl was in his senior year at Concord University in Mercer County, West Virginia, when he had some routine blood work done during a hospital admission. That's how he learned.
They found out that I was infected with HIV.
He thinks he contracted the disease from a same-sex partner. Even though he used protection, he says his partner was careless one time. He says it's been a struggle telling people he has HIV because of the stigma against people with the disease. We're using his first name only because Carl still hasn't told everyone in his family.
I have two people out of my entire family that know.
Even among some doctors, Carl says, he encounters homophobia. He recalls an early visit to a doctor in nearby Beckley.
She, in so many words, said, "Well, if I were you, I wouldn't have done the actions to get this." And that set me back. That sent me spiraling that a medical professional that deals with these infections would be so crass to somebody that was so mentally fragile anyway, because I just got that diagnosis.
Carl stopped taking his medication for a few days. He says he almost gave up. Then he contacted the Ryan White program at Charleston Area Medical Center, where he now makes the 2-hour round-trip drive for checkups. The stigma against people with HIV and AIDS can have a huge impact in rural communities. It affects what treatment options are available and makes it difficult for health officials to respond quickly to a possible outbreak. Tanya Basta, who chairs the Health Sciences College at Ohio University, has done research on the effects of stigma in rural Appalachia.
There are providers who, in rural areas, unfortunately, are still stigmatizing against their patients. And
West Virginia does not have a high number of people with HIV or AIDS, but researchers like Basta worry there could be undiagnosed cases, especially in the rural areas of the state.
Testing is an issue, and I'm not saying that stigma is necessarily any higher in rural areas. It's just that because of the nature of living in small towns where everybody kind of knows everybody, word travels quickly.
Few people living with HIV or AIDS in southern West Virginia are willing to tell their stories in public. Elena Imes is one of them. She has lived with the disease for 18 years. For many years before the disease progressed, Imes says she did not know she had been infected by her husband. She worries that there are many undiagnosed cases in her community.
Part of the problem is the negativity of the disease itself and the fear and the stereotyping. If you got AIDS, you probably did something bad, Christianly bad. They don't want anybody to see them go take a test. Consequently, people don't go take the test.
She's told her story to the media several times, but speaking out has caused some backlash. A few years ago, she experienced an incident where she worked at Walmart. A woman recognized her from a TV news story and knew that she had AIDS.
"I know you're from the TV. You're killing us all."
The woman yelled this in the parking lot, drawing a crowd. She accused Imes of infecting people with HIV by touching things when she stocked the shelves.
"I'm sorry. I don't really like telling people because that hurts so bad. So embarrassed." And that woman really thought she was warning everybody.
Imes lives in a small wooden house in Coal City in Raleigh County, where she runs a small animal rescue service. As we step through the front door, pink curtains and a thin layer of frayed plastic covers holes in her windows. When I visited, she wore 5 layers of clothes indoors to keep warm. She weighs less than 80 pounds. Her health is deteriorating, and she's struggling to get by.
"Financially, I'm in ruin."
She doesn't work at Walmart anymore. That's partly because a few years ago, she lost her mode of transportation. One night, she tried to hitchhike to work and was raped. Her perpetrators were never caught. Now she worries that those who raped her are unintentionally spreading the disease. As I listened to her story and Carl's, I wondered, why do they stay where they are? Im says one reason is because she wants to stay and help other people who have the disease.
"I would tell them that the worst thing they can do is to keep it a secret. If you can toughen up, you need to share it. Be open about it. That's the problem. If more people were open, then the stigma wouldn't be there."
Because she's been in the media telling her story, over the years, Imes has become almost a one-woman support system for people here who have HIV. That's something Carl says people need more of.
"The biggest fear that someone with this has, this infection has, is doing it alone. And that often causes you to become depressed because you are lonely."
I asked him if he ever thinks about leaving home, moving to a bigger city.
"I would rather live here and put up a front than move somewhere and be myself. I know that sounds kind of odd, but I do love this place. It is a beautiful place."
Although he is worried that his friends and family will find out he has HIV after the story airs, Carl says it's worth the risk because he hopes telling his story might help someone decide to get tested for HIV. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Roxy Todd in Beckley, West Virginia.
And finally, WMMT's own Benny Becker reports on the water crisis in Martin County, Kentucky.
A water system in Kentucky on the verge of collapse could soon get much-needed improvements. Some Martin County, Kentucky residents were without water for much of the time this winter in a crisis that put the spotlight on problems common throughout Appalachian coal country. Nearly $5 million in federal funding is now on the way, but as Benny Becker reports, it comes amid lingering questions about how local officials have managed the water system.
The water system has been a contentious issue for over a decade in Martin County, a community that has mined billions of dollars worth of coal, but has been left with crumbling infrastructure and a poverty rate of nearly 40%. As the Resource reported last January, residents have complained that their water is often contaminated and frequently shut off without warning. The county's top elected official, Judge Executive Kelly Callahan, said he thought the complaints were overblown.
Do we have problems with the water system? We do. But not one time have you seen Martin County out of water for several weeks at a time. It won't happen. We have too good a system for that.
This past winter, the county's water intake froze and neighboring districts weren't able to provide extra water, so some sections of Martin County had their water cut off every day for over a week. Many were forced to draw water from creeks and springs to be able to drink, bathe, and flush their toilets. You can imagine this brought out some anger. At one public meeting, Martin County resident Gary Hunt was grabbed by the throat and arrested after using a cuss word as he expressed his frustration.
I asked for 275 pounds of you used the wrong. That's disorderly conduct. Come on.
That incident was captured by local TV station EKB News. It quickly went viral and brought a whole new wave of media coverage. That attention has helped Martin County to find funding. The Water District has now been awarded nearly $5 million in federal grants in the last year, including $3.4 million announced this past weekend from Kentucky's portion of the Abandoned Mineland Fund. Meanwhile, many of the people responsible for the Water District have resigned. The Water District is currently under investigation by the Public Service Commission for the third time in 15 years. At a recent hearing, Commissioner Michael Schmidt had this to say about the Martin County Water District.
This is by far the worst water district, in my opinion, in the state of Kentucky. Worst run.
Martin County has a long history of struggling to find reliable leadership. A number of the county's elected officials have faced charges for embezzlement over the years. Denise Thomas of the Big Sandy Area Development District helped to write the Water District's grant proposal. She says it hasn't yet been determined who will manage the newly awarded funds, but her office will definitely remain involved. Thomas also works with utilities in neighboring counties, and she says that many of them are in a similar situation.
Keeping the utility system running, it's a challenge for all of our rural communities.
Gail Bryan, a water system expert and professor at the University of Kentucky, says this fits into a pattern that can be seen in many marginalized areas.
Here's a community that can't afford to replace their infrastructure, but they're ignored until something large and catastrophic happens.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Benny Becker in Whitesburg, Kentucky, where my water was just cut off yesterday.
You've had your day. Don't put her down.
That's it for this week's edition of Mountain News and World Report. If you'd like to hear this or previous episodes again, you can visit our website, www.wmmt.org, or download Mountain News wherever you get your podcasts. A song on this edition is Carla Gover singing Don't Put Her Down, You Helped Put Her There from the June Apple recording. I've been your host, Rachel Gehringer. Thanks for listening, and
from all of us at Apple Shop,
happy International Women's Day.
That was really singy. From all of us at Apple Shop.
Call yourself a man and say you just don't understand how a woman can turn out that way.
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.